So, Bubsy the Bobcat, he kind of sucks, right? Bubsy 3D death animation. But like, what if he didn't suck? What if Bubsy was fun? What if somebody could make a Bubsy game that actually played well? Free of all the strange physics problems, bland level design, and overly chatty characters. What if Bubsy was even cool? What could possibly go wrong? Let's rewind a bit, because I gotta tell you a story first. Chapter 1. The setup. It's the mid-2000s. 2005, to be exact. And my friends and I are all sitting around on IRC, undoubtedly commiserating at the reveal of Sega's Shadow the Hedgehog video game. Sonic the Hedgehog had just been inducted into something known as the Walk of Game, a riff on Hollywood's real Walk of Fame, where famous celebrities physically leave their mark on the sidewalk. The Walk of Game was meant to be that for video games. But instead of creating a handprint and signature in a slab of concrete, the Walk of Game was just a bunch of metal plaques with names written on them inside Sony's Metrion shopping center. It was kind of a dumb idea, and only lasted for 2 years, but Sonic ended up being one of the first round inductees. Sega celebrated this by putting out a sizzle reel of Sonic's best games. It was all blue skies, running fast, and fun times. Those vibes were immediately wrecked when, at the end of the sizzle reel, Shadow the Hedgehog literally shot his way through the footage. We thought it was a joke. It had to be. The tonal whiplash was insane. And this Walk of Game reveal trailer released in May of 2005, so it wasn't even that far off from April Fool's. Maybe they were just late to the party. Right? Right? It wasn't a joke. So here we were, sitting there doing the AVGN. What were they thinking? To each other, back and forth. And naturally, as Sonic fans tended to do back then, the conversation fell on the familiar topic. That Sega doesn't know what made Sonic cool, and things would be better if Sonic fans got to make the games themselves. This was a good 12 years before Sonic Mania, where Sega actually let Sonic fans make and release their very own Sonic game. But we knew better. It was 2005. Social media hadn't really been invented, YouTube didn't even exist yet, and generally it was a lot harder to talk to people because everybody was a lot more spread out. There was no universe in which any of us had a direct connection to Sega. Heck, even the idea that you could stroll up to a Sega brand manager at something like Comic-Con was still basically impossible at this point, because those kinds of events were a lot smaller too. A lot of us were in the heart of the Sonic fan gaming scene, a website called the Sonic Fan Games HQ, and this community was starting to enter a major renaissance, leading up to projects like Retro Sonic, Sonic Before the Sequel and Sonic Classic. Working on an official Sonic game was the ultimate daydream, the first steps down the road that lead to Sonic Mania. But, at least at the time, we accepted that Sega would never let Sonic fans take a crack at an official, company-funded product. There were too many cultural, language, skill and financial barriers. It would never happen. Around this time, a curious story had developed in tandem. An aspiring fan of the NES classic, River City Ransom, had discovered that the trademark to the franchise had lapsed in America. So, raising a bit of money, this fan, named Armin Kasargian, registered the trademark for himself, and quietly set about creating his own River City Ransom 2 for what he thought was a dead and abandoned game franchise. Eventually, Technos, the original developers of the Japanese version of River City Ransom, showed up with their own, updated port of the game for the Game Boy Advance. Nobody at the company had even bothered checking if they owned the rights. They just assumed it was still theirs. Armin, for his part, did not want to stand in the way of one of his favorite game series, so he turned the rights over to Technos and his fan-made version of River City Ransom 2 never saw the light of day. But it made us wonder, if it was so easy to find a dormant game property like River City Ransom and just register our own new trademark for it, what else could we do that for? Specifically, if Sega would never let us touch Sonic with a 100-foot pole, could we possibly get the next best thing? After all, the early to mid-1990s were flooded by Sonic clones. Everyone had their own mascot with attitude, from Konami's High Seas Havoc to IREM's Rocky Rodent on the SNES. Tiny Toons got in on the action. Chester Cheetah was in there. Garfield was there. We had Smug Bugs, Kung Fu Squirrels, Bat Acrobatics, and Punky Skunks. Even Sony, for how much bravado they had in thrashing Sega and the Saturn, had a flagship mascot game that was codenamed Sonic's Ass during development. We whittled the list down pretty quickly and decided there was one singular best-case scenario. Bubsy the Bobcat. Bubsy had a lot going for him. We agreed that the very first Bubsy game from 1993 really wasn't so bad. It wasn't great, it had a lot of problems, especially in later levels, but it had a charm and a personality that most Sonic clones lacked. Bubsy also understood and replicated more of Sonic's base mechanics than most Sonic clones did, too. Most 90s mascot platformers simply were about going fast, without understanding the ebb and flow that makes Sonic so special. Bubsy didn't get it perfect, but it did a better job than its contemporaries. Bubsy also had notoriety going for him. Though that first Bubsy game was kind of okay, the three following Bubsy sequels had such a sharp drop in quality that Bubsy became synonymous with some of the worst games ever made. There was a redemption arc just begging to be made. Everybody loves an underdog story. Plus, the idea of somebody like Bubsy upstaging Sonic himself also seemed incredibly funny. It could be the perfect storm. I ended the night doing a sketch of Bubsy and it was filed away as one of those ideas that would be cool to do someday. Chapter 2. Development begins. Even though a lot of friends that night seemed to forget about our Bubsy pact, it just wouldn't leave my head. So, after a few years passed, struck with boredom and creative energy one night, I started working on a tiny little Bubsy project. This was back when I was kinda sorta still thinking about game hoaxes, so I was thinking about what Bubsy would look like if there was a port for the Game Boy Advance. But, truth be told, the whole thing was kind of half-hearted. I don't think I worked on it for longer than a single weekend. A full week at most. Long enough to get some basic movement mechanics and that was it. Though, fun fact. For those of you who remember my Overbite Game Jam game from 2016, the sound of Dracula taking damage in that game was actually originally created for this Bubsy project. I still have the original sound file I made in Florida Studio, and it's literally just called, Bubsy_take_damage.wave. I just never got far enough in the coding to actually need the sound file, so it kind of gathered dust. As other things in my life took priority, my interest in doing a Bubsy game once again shifted onto the back burner for many, many years. It was something I earmarked to come back to later because it was something I wanted to explore in more detail someday, eventually. And no matter how far away I got from the project, it continued to nag at me. For 11 years, I thought about that Bubsy Game Boy Advance project, swearing that one day, I'd go back to it. And, in 2019, I finally did. Or I tried to. The thing about not touching a project for 11 years is that you both grow a lot, and forget a lot. As it turned out, that old Bubsy project was full of messy spaghetti code and the actual mechanics were so simple it kind of wasn't worth salvaging. I'd planned to revisit the code to jokingly tease a fake Bubsy game for April Fools that year, like a Sonic Mania type game, but for Bubsy. I figured I could use the old project as a base and work off of it from there, but everything was so messy that figuring it out and improving things would be a greater waste of time than just starting over from scratch. But I knew better. I knew there was another shortcut that would help me massively. Enter. Sonic Worlds Delta. You see, classic Sonic games control a very specific, special way. If you never really understood why Sonic fans got so bent out of shape over games like Sonic 4, it's because that game is missing the nuance that makes Sonic feel good to control. Early in the history of fans making Sonic fan games, there was always this struggle to figure out how to replicate that secret sauce so that Sonic actually felt like Sonic. And most of us, myself included, could never quite get it right. Until a man by the name of Demesian came to the community. He understood coding and math well enough that he created the very first proper Sonic physics engine, where Sonic could finally, accurately react to slopes and hills the way he did in the Genesis games. That ended up being part of a wider effort where Sonic fans really began to dig in deep and understand the tech underlying the Genesis games. We ended up with a Sonic Retro Physics Guide, which decompiles and explains the underlying code powering classic Sonic games. And that, in turn, led to the creation of Sonic Worlds, a coding framework utilizing both Demesian's concepts and the decompilation efforts of Sonic Retro to create the de facto template for almost every 2D Sonic fan game made in the last decade and a half. It's the code that powered both Sonic before the sequel, after the sequel, and even the first Freedom Planet and sparked the Electric Jester. At the time, the main branch was known as Sonic Worlds Delta, created for Click Team Fusion, the game development tool I've been using basically for my entire life. I'm so comfortable in Click Team Fusion I even contributed code to Sonic Worlds Delta itself. A fair amount of the code for the playable Shadow the Hedgehog character was written by me. As a small sidebar, the current version of Sonic Worlds is known as Sonic Worlds Next, as the entire framework is being rewritten for the Godot engine. Sonic Worlds Delta was incredibly robust. So robust that I opted for an offshoot called Simple Sonic Worlds, which pared the code down to the bare essentials. Given Sonic Worlds pushes Click Team Fusion to its limits, it can sometimes have nasty performance problems, and I was hoping the simple version would help alleviate that. If I wanted to get a Bubsy fan game up and running quickly, converting this version of Worlds Delta was the fastest and easiest option, Given I was already pretty familiar with how it worked. It still wasn't enough time. I only had a few weeks to assemble something noteworthy, and before I knew it, it was March 31st and I had something that only just barely resembled Bubsy. This wasn't really anything new. Games are a lot of work and I'd missed deadlines for funny April Fool's projects before, so this was just another one of those for the pile. But then something interesting happened. Chapter 3. Getting Serious. Q. Digital Foundry Retro Intro for their Bubsy documentary. Digital Foundry, a YouTube channel best known for their deep dives into the technology behind both new and old games, put out a 25-minute documentary on the development and legacy of Bubsy on April Fool's that same year. Clearly, there was something in the water, and it was all pulling us towards Bubsy. Despite technically being an April Fool's joke, Digital Foundry's Bubsy video was completely earnest. A true, mostly uneironic appreciation of all of Bubsy's games, from people who seemed to have genuine attachment to the character. Through their research, they revealed that once upon a time, Bubsy was actually considered a good game. That original 1993 game received above-average review scores in magazines of the era. The game was considered a cut above the usual smarmy mascot cash cows. For one extremely brief, fleeting moment, people enjoyed Bubsy and wanted more. At that moment, I suddenly felt a rush of vindication. All this time I'd spent thinking about the possibility of a new Bubsy game, feeling like a borderline crazy person, and yet, it was possible to be normal about this. Somewhat. Kind of. A little bit. With renewed vigor, I looked back towards my own Bubsy project, and knew I could have something special on my hands. I may have missed April Fool's 2019, but who said I had to release it on April Fool's? I could simply release it when it was done. It turned into a project I worked on between other, more pressing deadlines. Months would pass with no forward progress on Bubsy, but bit by bit, it was coming together. Holiday Break 2020 saw massive strides as huge parts of Sonic World's Delta transformed from playing like a Sonic game to playing more like Bubsy. Because that was the thing. I didn't want this to play like a Sonic game with a Bubsy graphics pack over the top of it. Whenever possible, I wanted this to remain true to that original 1993 game, while also featuring improved controls, modernized mechanics and whatever else sanded down the roughest, most dated edges. Internally, I began using the codename, Better Bubsy. Chapter 4. Improving Controls. The first thing I wanted to do was fix the controls. They're one of the most important things in a game. If you can't control the game, then you don't have a game. Bubsy's original controls were weird, to put it simply. As the story goes, Bubsy's creator, Mike Berlin, played Sonic the Hedgehog for over 100 hours trying to understand what made that game work so well. As a result, Bubsy is fast. Almost too fast. When running on a flat surface or down hills, Bubsy can accelerate to what can feel faster than some Sonic games. It looks really impressive, but creates several problems. The most obvious one is that it's pretty difficult to see what's ahead of Bubsy, and everything in this game can kill you in one hit. If you truly cut loose and let Bubsy take off at full sprint, you're going to regret it sooner rather than later. Let's say you want to slow down. Like Sonic the Hedgehog, getting Bubsy to skid to a stop is relatively simple. But maybe, during this skid, you tell Bubsy to jump. What you'll discover is that Bubsy actually starts fighting back against your controls. If you were running to the right, jump, and push to the left, you end up in this weird tug of war with the game where a secondary force of momentum will keep pulling you to the right no matter what. At best, you can only slow Bubsy down, but you'll never get him to turn around completely, and it's not limited to just jumping. Anytime Bubsy leaves the ground for any reason, you have to fight against some predetermined sense of momentum. It's completely awkward. Unless, you push the other jump button. If you didn't know, Bubsy actually has two jump buttons, and on the surface, both look and function nearly the same. The key difference is that while the primary button just jumps, if you push and hold the secondary button, Bubsy will spread his arms and start to glide through the air. The only way you'd ever know either button did anything differently is by the fact that the secondary button doesn't jump quite as high as the primary does. So generally, the way Bubsy is played, is that you use the primary button for all your jumping and only hold down the secondary button to start gliding once you're already in the air. And once you're gliding, that strange tug of war in Bubsy's air control goes away. But it's replaced with a new problem, where Bubsy now never slows down at all. If you pop into a glide at full speed and push the opposite direction, Bubsy shoots off in that direction still at full speed. So your options in Bubsy are basically not having enough air control versus having way too much. So, I simplified it. A single jump button, with the alternate button being used for gliding only. I considered only using one button for both jumping and gliding, But one sign of a good platformer is being able to vary your character's jump height based on how long you hold down the button. Having the glide automatically activate when you do a full strength jump doesn't feel very good to me. Ergo, gliding gets its own dedicated button. In terms of general air control, Bubsy functions mostly like Sonic does, where you retain all maneuverability while in the air. But I made it so that while gliding, Bubsy is a little slower to turn around, since I figured there needs to be some balance against the benefit of gliding. To put it another way, if there's no downsides to gliding, people are just going to be gliding all the time. Since you allow the player to stop gliding, you need to have a reason for that. That means there needs to be a downside to gliding, which in this case is that Bubsy feels a little more sluggish to turn around while gliding. When on the ground, things are pretty normal, though I made some modifications to the way the physics work in Sonic Worlds. Generally speaking, Sonic Worlds tries to simulate the restrictions of how the classic Sonic games work. I can already tell this video is getting kind of long, so I'll try to keep it simple, but... So Sonic is notable for reacting to slopes with some degree of realism. Running uphill is slow, and running downhill helps you pick up speed faster. The Sega Genesis isn't powerful enough to calculate these kinds of physics in real time, so they fake a lot of it by having invisible tiles that tell the engine the angle of every slope in the entire game. The way Click Team Fusion works, that's not really feasible for something like Sonic Worlds, and it ends up actually being easier to calculate the physics in real time. But it still keeps things locked down to specific angles to mimic the look and feel of the original games. It's only in certain circumstances, like when Sonic rolls into a ball, that Sonic Worlds will enable the true, fully unlocked physics simulation. So, I went into the code and made it so it's always running the full angle detection and physics simulation routines at all times. That can make Bubsy feel a little heavy and slippery though, so I also went in and added some simple division math to reduce the effect slopes have on Bubsy's movement. All of this makes Bubsy feel way more responsive to his environment without it feeling overbearing. Somewhere in here. One thing I have noticed over the years is that when a person doesn't like classic Sonic, it's generally because they think he's too difficult to control. They think he takes too long to get moving, and takes too long to stop. There's too much momentum. So, here, I've tweaked Bubsy's top speed and acceleration in the hopes of making him feel a little tighter to control. This Bubsy gets up to speed faster than Sonic does, but he's got a lower top speed overall. The hope is to make him feel more nimble and less like a runaway freight train. And don't get me wrong. In my heart of hearts, I am a Sonic fan first and foremost, and I love a runaway freight train as much as the next guy. But Bubsy is not Sonic, and there's no shame in experimenting with different approaches in the name of greater accessibility. The one last thing I did should be Indie Game 101 by this point. I gave Bubsy the Coyote Time mechanic popularized by Celeste. If you've never heard of this system before, basically what happens is that most games are pretty rigid in how they respond to input. The character will only jump if the game knows their feet are touching the floor. Coyote Time is named after what happens in Roadrunner cartoons, where Wile E. Coyote sometimes goes charging off a cliff only to hang in the air for a second or two before gravity catches up to him. In terms of gameplay mechanics, Coyote Time gives the player a bit of wiggle room when pushing the jump button. If the player is not on the ground, but the jump button is pushed a few frames before touching the ground, or even a few frames after leaving the ground, it will still trigger a valid jump action. Basically, it means the game is more forgiving when it comes to not dropping your inputs on accident, and it makes the jump controls feel way better overall. Chapter 5. Improving Sound. With basic control improvements set up, I moved on to improving the sound. Bubsy, like a number of American-made games of this era, fashions itself as something of a playable cartoon. As such, it pulls a number of digitized cartoon sounds from the Hanna-Barbera sound library. Did you know that Hanna-Barbera has actually released gigantic collections of all their classic cartoon sound effects on CD? Though it's harder to find now, there used to be a time where you could get it on Amazon for pretty cheap, and different versions turn up on eBay every now and then, usually for $50 or less. It's a far cry from the $500 they demand for modern digital versions of the collection. There are also places like the Sound Effects Wiki, which categorizes and lets you listen to every instance of every stock sound effect ever used in movies, TV and cartoons, and their page on Hanna-Barbera's library is extensive. What this means is that it's actually incredibly easy to find and get high-quality versions of every sound used in the original Bubsy, as well as gaining access to a vast library of other, similar sounds to further enhance the soundscape of Bubsy's world. For example, in the original Bubsy, these trained trolley creatures made no sound at all. They would suddenly appear, and silently roll off screen. In Better Bubsy, you hear a bell to signal when they're near, and a gentle clickety-clack as they roll down the track. Plus, with a little bit of extra coding magic, I even made the sounds positional, so you can tell if the train trolley is on your right or left. That's another one of those universal game design lessons. Always give the player more feedback about the world around them, not less. In the original game, these fat taxicab enemies only have a single sound effect when you bop them. Since the Hanna-Barbera library has so many different car horn sounds, in Better Bubsy, I made it pick from 3 or 4 at random, just to add a little bit of variety. When it came to Bubsy's iconic voice lines, things started to get tricky. As far as anyone knows, the original high-quality voice recordings for Bubsy have never surfaced online, meaning we're technically stuck with whatever was available on the Sega Genesis.
What could possibly go wrong?
Dot and the Super Nintendo.
What could possibly go wrong?
Both sound pretty crusty, but what people might not know is that Bubsy actually got an obscure pseudo-remaster for the PC in 1996 called Super Bubsy. Though the visuals are weird and the controls are worse than ever, it does actually contain somewhat higher quality versions of all of Bubsy's voice clips.
What could possibly go wrong?
Now, there's a lot of background noise, but having some experience with audio engineering and sound remastering, it wasn't very difficult to coax out something that sounded considerably better.
What could possibly go wrong?
When compared to the Super Nintendo version of Bubsy, the difference is significant.
What could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong?
As another sidebar, I'd also like to say that while Bubsy kind of has a reputation for being a little too chatty, the number of voice lines in that first game is actually pretty low. Bubsy basically only really talks over level title cards and never says much of anything otherwise. It's not really until Bubsy 3D that they went overboard on giving him tons of quips. So for the few of you out there cringing at the idea of hearing tons of high-quality Bubsy voice lines, well, don't, I guess. It's really not a problem here. Speaking of basic sound engineering, I also went through the trouble of touching up the music a little bit. Now, those of you who know that I like to tinker with MIDIs. Basically, I like to load up a MIDI in Florida Studio and apply high-quality instruments and nice effects to make them sound better. So there will be a MIDI that sounds like this. And I make it sound like this. And Super Bubsy does actually come with official MIDIs for the game's entire soundtrack. In theory, I could work some magic and make something that sounds like a lost 1990s multimedia soundtrack. But maybe it's my own imposter syndrome talking, but it never sounds right. And since I'm more of a sound engineer than a composer, this is about as good as I can get it to sound. So instead, I chose to apply some modern mixing and remastering to the existing soundtrack. Music files for the Super Nintendo come in a format called SPC, which is a bit like Amiga tracker music, for those of you who know what that is. Some SPC players can actually let you resample sound output and toggle different effects, so while Bubsy for the Super Nintendo had this ugly, ever-present reverb effect, the SPC player software lets me disable that prehistoric reverb, boost the sampling rate, and export the song into something I can use in Florida Studio. Afterwards, I reapply studio-grade reverb and some additional equalization and mastering. So whereas a song sounded like this on the SNES, after my remastering, it now sounds like this. It's both faithful to the original soundtrack while sounding a lot better in my opinion, and requires a little bit less work on my part since I no longer have to agonize over the sound of individual instruments. Chapter 6, Improving Graphics. So Bubsy controls well and sounds good. What's next? Graphics. In an ideal world, I would remake all of the sprites from scratch. I'm a pretty decent pixel artist, but doing that would take an exorbitant amount of time, and a lot of fan games are known for reusing existing assets anyway. The problem is that there aren't a lot of Bubsy sprite rips, and there were even less when I started working on this project. So, in order to remake any of the levels, I had to rely on the old standby trick of loading Bubsy up in an old version of ZNES, turning off some of the background layers, and taking thousands upon thousands of screenshots, frame by frame. Most games nowadays either already have their graphics already ripped, or have some kind of PC port where the files can be directly converted and hosted on the Spriter's resource. But, back in the day, taking screenshots and manually clipping out sprites by hand was the only way. And it can't even be any old screenshots, either. They have to be uncompressed and at the console's base resolution, you can't upscale them or have any kind of filtering applied. It has to be the rawest, most basic output possible. Now, like the rest of the game, I didn't just use the original graphics wholesale. With this rock wall, I ran it through a filter to remove the dithering, and then blended it with the original sprites to give the appearance of being higher color while not looking too smudged or blurry. The grass in Bubsy was basically already just the old MS Paint spray can tool, making it easy to draw my own grass shapes while also being slightly higher color. Though speaking in present tense, I kind of want to replace this grass with something that looks better. When it comes to decorations, Bubsy levels don't have a lot. The first world gives you rock backgrounds, grass, the hint of blue cobblestone, a few residential buildings, one potted plant, and a single type of tree. There's also some waterfalls and sewer stuff, but still. I thought my levels felt kind of empty, so, I went in and expanded the visual variety a little bit. For starters, I created fir and birch trees, just to give a better sense of ecology. I gave some of the houses these little wooden fences, with optional tufts of tall grass. And in places where the car monsters are known to roam, I created these little stop sign graphics to let players know they're nearby, as one of the things I hated about the original Bubsy was how easy it was to run into enemies you didn't know were there. Now you know what to look out for. Again, more player feedback about the world around them is always a good thing. Bubsy also loves to use caves to warp players around levels, but I wasn't a huge fan of the original cave graphics. So I gave them big stone archways to make it clearer that they were, in fact, doorways. As for these semi-solid dock platforms, I kit-bashed them from Sonic Advance graphics. Lastly, I made these no swimming signs, or, I guess they say, don't swim. And I use them as a way to communicate that, true enough, you really shouldn't try to make Bubsy go swimming. Or at least not in this level, as the original game did eventually have levels with safer bodies of water. Incidentally, normally Bubsy just slowly sinks in the water. But I figured it would be more fun to add piranhas jumping out around him, as if he was getting nibbled as he sank. It's maybe a little hard to tell with a low resolution, but hopefully the biting sounds help sell it. And, you know, all of these new graphics really fill out the first world and make the environment feel more alive. As yet another sidebar. Something I discovered while ripping these graphics and building the game's first level is that the original Bubsy doesn't have a lot of walls. You sometimes encounter a few here and there, like down in the underground sections of the first world, and during the teleporter maze at the end of world 2. But by and large Bubsy will let you take off moving horizontally without much to stop you, no matter how dangerous that prospect actually is in practice. I didn't want to replicate that in my game. Walls seem like a pretty fundamental element of navigation in most side-scrolling platform games, so that means I had to figure out a way to take Bubsy's existing graphics and create logical-looking walls for the players to have to jump up and over. I think I ended up figuring something out that works well enough. By now you've also probably noticed these crates with the boxing gloves on them. 4 years before Crash Bandicoot solidified ownership as the platformer with crates, Bubsy had plenty of crates scattered around its levels. They contained yarn stashes and hazards like tacks that hurt Bubsy. Or, perhaps, heavy anvils. In truth, the only thing resembling a wall in most Bubsy levels. I added my own crate to the mix, the boxing glove crate. Earlier I said I didn't want better Bubsy to just be Sonic with a Bubsy graphics pack, but this is one of those instances where I let Sonic mechanics leak back in. Boxing glove crates are effectively just a Sonic spring, but instead, a giant boxing glove shoots out and punches Bubsy, launching him in a given direction. I'm not a fan of being cynical about how hated Bubsy is, but seeing him get smacked around is a pretty funny visual and expands what's possible in the level design. When it comes to enemy graphics, to some degree, I was able to reply on Dolphman's rip of Bubsy's enemies over at the Spriter's resource, though it is far from complete. The most common enemy in Bubsy are the Woolies, the alien race that have come to Earth to steal all of our yarn. In Dolphman's rip, only about half of the Woolies' total sprites for World 1 are present. Sprites showing woolies walking around, kicking cheese wheels, and getting angry when they fail an attack are all missing from Dolphman's rip. It's not something we have to worry about right now, but woolies also wear unique costumes for every world they're in. In the carnival, they dress like clowns, for example. None of those sprites are in Dolphman's rip, so should I make it that far, I will have to rip those, too. As one last note, I also tried not to use these sprites wholesale. And by that I mean, when people see retro games in an emulator, they think that's just the way they looked. These old games were designed to render on a CRT screen, which is naturally higher contrast than a modern LCD. So an accurate emulator respecting the color values produced by the console will display an image that actually looks a little washed out. So when it comes to enemy sprites, even Bubsy's own sprites, I tried to give them a little contrast bump in order to restore proper white values and make them look more accurate to the way they would have been seen on a retro display. I also tried to dabble with CRT overlay shaders, but to be honest, ClickTeam Fusion's shader support is pitiful and deeply outdated. If I remember right, it only supports up to Pixel Shader Model 2, when most of the world is on Pixel Shader Model 5. Most resources, like ShaderToy, just aren't compatible. I also have no idea where to even start creating shader code, and ClickTeam provides zero resources or tutorials. Shader Model 2 debuted over 20 years ago, so I can't imagine too much information is still around. What I ended up going with is a layered combination of 2 to 3 different shaders in the hopes of achieving the desired look. My gold standard for this effect is something like LOTS CRT with the settings turned down, because I like a softer, more gentle CRT effect. I think I get within the ballpark of that effect, though I do provide 3 presets for the user to toggle between if you want something a little stronger. It's definitely not perfect, but it's the best I can do right now. Chapter 7. Difficulty Enhancements. Bubsy was a pretty difficult game. I don't think that's much of an understatement. Many years ago, when I was daydreaming about picking up the Bubsy IP on the cheap, one of my co-conspirators in that conversation was my friend Chess, who shares a similarly weird appreciation for Bubsy. I actually watched her stream Bubsy many years ago, and for a time, it was her crowning achievement to be able to persevere through the last couple worlds and actually finish the game, because it doesn't just get mean, it gets clumsy. Difficulty balancing is something I care about deeply, because it's so easy to mess up. Not only do a lot of indie developers get it wrong, but a lot of old-school game developers got it wrong back then, too. And I've gotten it wrong, too. I'll never let myself live down the time Kevin Pereira called out one of my games as being super difficult on live TV, after a solid month of me debating with my playtesters over whether or not to make the game easier.
It's great, and what I really like about it is that it included some really tough boss battles.
Awesome.
Which, you know,
which the Mario games don't typically have very tough
They do
boss
not.
Battles,
they do not. So. I mean, here you're taking on the old King Boo,
oh.
And you know, you've got it's actually kind of inventive. You got to jump up, you got to open up the window blinds or the shades there, which put the light on him, and then you got to hit him in his heart. He'll die. It's actually kind of hard. There's a flaming pumpkin king as well.
Wow.
Which you'll see in a second. Get a big crowd for winning. Look at that. And I just got my ass handed to me by this guy. But that's okay.
Cool.
Turns out they were right, and I was wrong. A fact bolstered by me trying to revisit my own game decades later and also finding it to be a little too difficult. I tend to be a little more forgiving of old games that are difficult, however. It's always important to remember that back then, it was kind of the Wild West. A lot fewer people knew what made games fun and were just kind of making their best guess. A lot of games that seemed clumsy or obtuse or strange often just didn't know better. Difficulty back then was also just how you gave a game length. In his YouTube series about game development, Super Smash Bros. Director Masahiro Sakurai mentions that high difficulty was often a way to mitigate storage limitations. If your game couldn't have a lot of levels, you took what levels you did have and made them super difficult in order to make it take longer to finish. This is particularly noteworthy once the game rental market of the 90s comes into the picture, where some developers have long since fully admitted to putting in big difficulty spikes just to deter players from finishing something on a rental. Bubsy is one of those games of a specific flavor, in that Bubsy himself is incredibly fragile and will die in one hit to pretty much anything he touches. And when we're talking about a game with wonky controls that also lets you run pretty fast, it starts to feel like a recipe for disaster. The further you get into Bubsy, the less it respects the player, too. You'll die to attacks from enemies that aren't even on screen, or upcoming hazards you never could have predicted. Bubsy tries to offset this a little bit. The game starts you with 9 lives, cause, you know, you're a cat, and the first world or two is rife with secret one-ups in order to help weather the coming storm. And two, every time Bubsy dies, there's some sort of wacky, Looney Tunes-style death animation. Bubsy will deflate like a balloon, or shatter like glass, or pancake on the ground. Huh, when you think about it, Crash Bandicoot took more from Bubsy than just crates, huh?
Whoa!
The idea is that if the death is funny, then it's not as frustrating. Unless, you know, you see 47 times in a row. But times have changed, and standards of difficulty have changed. Bubsy needs a refresh. My solution is a difficulty selector. I started out thinking of the two extremes. On one end of the spectrum, you have Bubsy's original difficulty. Everything kills Bubsy in one hit, including fall damage, something a 2D platformer should never, ever, ever have in my opinion. And, once you run out of lives, it's game over. For those hardcore retro gamers who really want it, this will remain present in better Bubsy as the classic mode difficulty. At the opposite end of the spectrum, we have something tentatively called casual mode. This is more like a modern video game. Bubsy has infinite lives, and taking a page from Sonic the Hedgehog, taking damage will simply cause Bubsy to lose a percentage of his current yarn. This means for players carrying large amounts of yarn, Bubsy can survive multiple hits, and the concept of fall damage ceases to exist. Bubsy only dies if taking damage while holding zero yarn. Now, the reason I went for casual mode, instead of calling it something like modern mode, to contrast against classic mode, is because I added a third difficulty option that sits between them called normal mode. This attempts to split the difference between both classic and casual mode. In normal mode, Bubsy still has lives. He still takes fall damage, though it doesn't instantly kill him and instead just does regular damage. Whereas casual mode lets you take multiple hits until you run out of yarn, taking damage in normal mode zeroes out your yarn entirely, meaning you can only take one hit before needing to collect more yarn. All three modes come with some form of benefit or penalty to Bubsy's score, with casual mode cutting potential score earnings in half, whereas classic mode doubles the score a player receives from collecting items and bopping enemies. I do this because I figure if you're the kind of player who still cares about score, you're also the kind of player that's probably going to suffer. Through classic mode, whereas casual mode players most likely care the least about earning points. But that's just raw modes, too. I also made a number of difficulty tweaks in other areas, with the general adherence to a single mantra: less dull, but more forgiving. Obviously that means throwing out all of Bubsy's original levels, as you might have already seen, but it also just means playing with how Bubsy uses and introduces mechanics and enemies. Now, by all means, I'm no expert level designer. But I've been looking at and thinking about this stuff long enough that I've come up with some general guidelines I try to follow. For starters, you should always be teaching the player something new or testing them on what they already know. You should be considering what a player is thinking and how they react to seeing everything for the first time, and turn that into a learning experience that eventually challenges them on what they've learned. And that includes the fact that your game is competing with at least 20 other games that also released that day. This isn't 2008 anymore. If your game doesn't hook someone in 90 seconds, they're gonna go back to Roblox, or Fortnite, or Rocket League, or Valorant, or League of Legends, or Counter-Strike 2, or geez, like, even Overwatch 2. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine playing Overwatch 2 in 2024? Some people do it, I don't understand it. Point is, there are a lot of games out there, and more importantly, a lot of free games. Even something like a free fan game is not necessarily guaranteed to have a person's full, undivided attention anymore. So generally I think having a short tutorial level works best. Not very long, not very complex, it's just there to get your foot in the door and say, hey, this is my game, and you've already finished one level. Don't you want to keep going? This is referred to in most media as the hook, and it's why the first level is often the most important thing in any game. Now, the first level is going to be something you will be staring at a lot, subtly tweaking many times over the course of development. Nothing is ever set in stone, not even once the game is out there in the public's hands. Generally speaking, you can usually fix it later, though not always. For now, the one thing I want to focus on is something petty. The first level in the original Bubsy is named Cheese Wheels of Doom, and one of the variants of the Woolies can summon a cheese wheel and kick it at Bubsy as a projectile. And yet, as far as I've ever found, there are no cheese wheel enemies in the level Cheese Wheels of Doom. So I'm fixing that. The first Wooly exists to communicate that these are your enemies for this game. He just stands there, occasionally trying to sneeze at you, or honk at you, whatever these guys do. I gave them a little bit of a spittle spray just to communicate you should probably not go near them, meaning your only option is to either jump over the monster or even bop them. It's not hard to deal with, but it's not supposed to be hard. It's like the first Goomba in a Mario game. It's there just to make sure you have a pulse. The very next thing you encounter is another standard Wooly alongside a Wooly perched above the player that kicks cheese wheels down at you. This is the game's first real, actual challenge. It's a tricky jump to reach the Wooly on the roof. It's tricky timing your jump around the wheels, and maybe you'll even discover you can bop the wheels like an enemy if you land on them from above. It also shows that rooftops of these buildings are fair game to traverse, too. A lot of vital information is densely compacted into this one screen here, and a simple jumping obstacle beforehand tries to slow the player down, shake them out of just holding forward, and fully understand what they're looking at before letting them progress. A lot of this first level is like that. This big hill here is designed to safely show players how Bubsy reacts to sloped surfaces. It ends by safely slowing the player down next to a segment that introduces two new enemy types. The level's pretty short, probably averaging most players less than 2 minutes total, but it's still got plenty of alternate pathways and secrets to discover, something that was a trademark of classic Sonic games and was also present in a lot of Bubsy levels. It's not until level 2, Forbidden Plummet, that we get our first, real, proper Bubsy level. Whereas the first level was around 14,000 pixels wide, level 2 is nearly twice that size, at 24,000. Not only that, but it's a considerably more vertical level, too, offering much more landscape to explore in all directions. There's just one problem though. Well, as of writing this script, level 2 is still not done yet. Now, you might be wondering, how is level 2 not done yet? You've been working on this game for 4.5 years. And my answer there is that, well, I've been busy. I only ever really think of this Bubsy project in the spring, usually around April, because I remember its original intention as a pseudo-April Fool's joke. So I'd work on it for a couple days, maybe a full week, and then it would go straight to the back burner again while I focused on things that actually make me money. Especially in the last couple years since my mom died, since I can't lean on her for support anymore. There's just no money to be made in developing a fan game, so it's relegated to a thing I can only work on in my free time, and I don't have a lot of that these days, and it feels like I have less all the time. Honestly, because I felt guilty showing level 2 as it originally was, I actually worked on this game more in the last month than I have since 2020. I fixed a handful of bugs, tweaked some mechanics, added a couple new features, and I worked a lot more on level 2. But it's still basically a skeleton compared to level 1. It still needs more work. A lot more work. And, to be clear, if you're thinking about launching a Kickstarter or a Patreon to support fangame development, so you can hire voice actors or other workers for your fangame project, don't. Don't do that. I've had ideas for a whole video about this topic kicking around in my head since the days of Sonic Smackdown's Patreon. But needless to say, if you start exchanging money for developing a Sonic fangame, you could start a domino effect that takes down way more games than just the one you're making. A company like Sega is tolerant of Sonic fangames for now, but you really should not give them any reason to be angry at you or the community you represent. Check your ego and your greed at the door. Fangames are a tribute of love, not a product of capitalism. There is simply no way to make fangames as a job. Unless. Chapter 8. So you're saying there's a chance?
People who love Bubsy love Bubsy. Eventually, like, a good Bubsy game needs to be made.
In theory, you'd keep your eye open for who's a good indie platforming team that might be interested in reviving Bubsy.
I think if there's good indie platforming teams and they want to reach out, we'd certainly be interested in hearing those things.
Okay. And they should reach out to...
they can reach out to the General Atari. You can go to the site and reach out. We watch it.
Okay.
We'll get it.
Okay.
That's Atari's current CEO, Wade Rosen, during an appearance on the MinMax podcast wherein he reaches out to any fans of Bubsy that would like to work with the IP. Atari is the current owner of the Bubsy IP, after it changed hands a few times over the years. The original four Bubsy games were all published under the banner of Accolade, a company probably most known for games like the original Test Drive and a bunch of sports games like Jack Nicklaus Golf. If you kids don't know who Jack Nicklaus is, he was kind of the Tiger Woods of the 80s and 90s. Heck, do kids today even know who Tiger Woods is? Well, I guess if you're watching a video about Bubsy, probably, right? Anyway, Accolade published a wide range of games, mostly on old PC DOS platforms at first, but they eventually started dipping their toes into console game publishing as well, with notorious games like Balls and Barkley, Shut Up and Jam. Footage of Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden. No, not that one. The original Barkley. The actual basketball game. Yeah, that one. Bubsy was pretty much their one and only platformer, which sort of puts into perspective how much importance they put on the character, how impressive that first game was considering they'd never done anything like that before, while also explaining how all of the other Bubsy games were such a mess. Accolade eventually hit a rough patch and were bought out by a French studio known as Infogrames in 1999. What was once known as Accolade was slowly absorbed and within a year it completely ceased to exist. It's here that things start to get a little weird, because at that same time, Infogrames also bought a company known as GT Interactive. Once upon a time, GT Interactive was a major player in the game space, publishing famous games like Quake, Unreal, and even Duke Nukem, all technically under the same banner. Somehow, despite publishing literally some of the most timeless first-person shooters ever created, they were gobbled up by Infogrames, who also grabbed whatever was left of the original Atari from the 1980s video game crash. 4 years after buying GT Interactive, Infogrames renamed the company to Atari for some reason. This new, mutated version of Atari also inherited a lot of old Accolade stuff, like the Test Drive franchise, and eventually set about putting more of those games out, in between remakes of classic 80s Atari franchises and Dragon Ball Z games. They too eventually fell on hard times, and in 2013 filed for bankruptcy. In order for the company to stay afloat, this version of Atari sold off some stuff that Infogrames hoarded all of those years ago, like the GT Interactive branding and the rights to a bunch of games. Somehow, this ended up with the Bubsy IP landing in the hands of a California-based company known as Tamo, who partnered with the Hong Kong studio BillionSoft to resurrect the Accolade name and produce two new Bubsy games, Woolies Strike Back and Paws on Fire. Woolies Strike Back was developed by the same people who made the Gianna Sisters reboot a few years earlier, a company by the name of Black Forest Games. And it's, I don't want to be too mean here, but it's not good. I own the PC version, and just getting the thing to launch without crashing is enough of a problem. If you can get it to work, it's not the worst thing ever made, but it doesn't play like a game anybody seemed very passionate about. Okay, that's a little unfair, given the amount of work that goes into any kind of professional game development. I have no doubt in my mind that there were some legitimately passionate people working on it who cared about making a good game. But the end result is a very bland platformer with boring visuals and forgettable music, even with Turrican's legendary Chris Hulsbeck providing the soundtrack. Paws on Fire fares a little better, but only a little, being developed by Choice Provisions, the developers of Bit Trip Runner. That's generally because Paws on Fire is literally just Bit Trip Runner 4, except instead of starring Commander Video, it stars Bubsy. And that's it, that's the whole video game. It's just Bit Trip Runner, again. Both of these modern Bubsy games are more than a little cynical, smugly cashing in on Bubsy's status as gaming's punching bag. Neither of them even tried to capture what people liked about that first game, outside of featuring a chatty cartoon bobcat that won't stop spouting annoyingly self-aware one-liners. And just as quickly as it came back, this is where the revival of Accolade ended. Just last year, 2023, the current incarnation of Atari bought back a lot of what it sold to Tamo and BillionSoft, including the rights to Bubsy, leading to the video at the start of this segment.
Eventually, like, a good Bubsy game needs to be made. If there's good indie platforming teams and they want to reach out, we'd certainly be interested in hearing those things. And
this was it. This was my chance. I could take what I had of my Bubsy game and pitch it to them officially. An honest Bubsy game. Earnest. A bigger, better remake of the first game, with the potential to extend it beyond the original. Maybe something closer to the Sonic Mania of Bubsy. A chance to do it right. And I know people. People who know people. I could get some fresher pixel art, truly remaster the music, really make the game look and sound nice.
So, having never written a pitch before, I fired off a message. I attached videos, screenshots, my development materials, and explained my process. I told them who I am, that I was the founder of Sage, that I'd made a Mario fan game that literally transformed an entire community. I even sent them a playable build of Better Bubsy, even though it was only one level and a half. It was the strongest shot I could muster, and I shot it as quickly as I could. Even if I'd been lazily working on Better Bubsy in fits and starts for the last 4 years, I wanted to be one of the first names in that inbox. And then I waited. And waited.
And waited.
Chapter 9, Waiting. Reference to Space Ghost episode Waiting. It's been 6 months. Probably more, given how long it's probably going to take me to put this video together. And I've had no response from Atari. That's not to say it'll never happen. The game industry, hell, most of America right now is in a bad place financially. I mean, have you looked at your local grocery store lately? The generic off-brand foods you used to buy to save money are sometimes more expensive than the real thing now, and most things are comfortably resting at prices nearly double what they were just a year ago. Danny O'Dwyer, who is probably infinitely more notable than I am, has documented his own struggles over at their No Clip channel. Danny has been producing a series about what it's like to make a game, and most recently, he released a video about their own woes in speaking to publishers. Which is to say, they haven't been speaking to them, not really. Because nobody is returning their calls, either. There just isn't a lot of money to go around for indie game publishing right now, and pitchers are getting ghosted constantly. Atari's open call for a new Bubsy might have actually come at the worst possible time to fund a game like that. But still, it's only been 6 months. According to people who know about this more than I do, sometimes that's just completely normal for a game pitch. It would be stupid to assume I was the only one who sent a message, so I'm sure my name is on a list somewhere, and it could be some time before it comes up. So if I haven't heard a response from Atari, then why do this video at all? It's kinda in a random place in development, after all. Well, recently I came across a video from a professional animator named Ranan about an E102 Gamma fangame prototype he started but kind of stalled out on developing. Much like Better Bubsy, he started it about 4 years ago, and according to him, it's kind of languished on the back burner since then. I figured if he could do a video like that, and make it interesting to hear his process, then I could do something with my Bubsy project. And I mean, like, I already mentioned NoClip's video series about developing a game. Game Maker's Toolkit has also been doing a series on making a game, and I watched Rube's entire series on remaking The Simpsons Hit and Run in Unreal Engine 5. It just seemed like something I could also make a video about, and inspiration struck. So the question now is, where do we go next? What do I do with the project after this video is done? Even if Atari never gets back to me, I think I want to release something that's playable. The original plan was just one level. But the thing is, I've done things like that before. And I think it kinda sucks. Plus, the first level, as it is so small and tiny that it would feel kind of like a ripoff to just release that. But then I fall into the trap of, well, if I'm going to do two levels, I could push myself to make it three, so I could include an updated version of the first boss at the end. In the most ideal scenario, I'd also do the entire carnival world too, because even if I'm trying to avoid making Better Bubsy too much like Sonic, having all of those rollercoaster tracks to play with is very tempting. It's kind of a frustrating level in the original Bubsy, because it punishes you for going fast more often than not, but I'd personally use it as a chance to let Bubsy cut loose and go full Sonic mode. So it's something I want to make. But, well, it's taken me 4 years to get this far, because fangames don't pay the bills. Nor should they, to be clear. This is a whole separate video I wanted to make someday, but you should not expect to get paid for making a fangame, nor should you expect to pay workers to help you make a fangame. There's a whole copyright ecosystem that, at least on some levels, needs to be respected, and I can understand if you think copyright law is outdated, cause, you know, it is. But the fact of the matter is this is something bigger than just the game you yourself are making. If you are making a fangame, you are intrinsically attached to a fan gaming community, and if you upset the people who own the copyright, you aren't just putting your project at risk, you're putting everybody at risk. Your project could be the first step in a domino effect that rolls through and shuts down a lot more than just what you're working on. And even if the law itself is wrong, it still can be enforced upon you and others by those who hold power. Until systemic change happens on a legal level, you have to be mindful not to step on the wrong toes. The good news is, that's usually pretty easy, actually. Make fan games all you want, but just don't sell them, don't profit from them, and don't pay others for them. A fan game is a tribute you create for a shared sense of love, but it is not a career. That means I have to focus on what pays so I can do things like buy groceries and eventually stop living with my brother, you know. Working on a Bubsy fan game is pretty much the bottom rung of the ladder in terms of priorities. But that doesn't mean development stops, it just means it's very, very, very slow. So basically, that means it'll be done when it's done. It'll come out eventually. Eventually, could be a year from now, it could be 5 years from now, it could even be 6 months from now, but it could also be never. It really depends on how financially comfortable I am and the amount of free time I'm afforded. It's like, there's an old adage, right, where you have three options. Do it fast. Do it cheap. Do it good. You can only pick two. You can have it fast and cheap, but that means it won't be good. If you want it cheap and good, then won't be fast, which is currently where I'm at. If you want it good and fast, that's up to whether Atari will pay me. And, like, come on. Considering games can cost many millions to develop, kicking a guy like me, say, $100,000 a year. That's pennies, comparatively. Or I assume, anyway. Again, I've kind of never done professional game development like this before. But $100,000 is comfortable living expenses for at least two people. Maybe, at most, $250,000 since we'd be talking at least one artist and a musician. Again, I don't know. I've never done this at a professional level before. But surely we would at least talk about that, I'd hope. Anyway, this video turned out a lot longer than I expected, and I even skipped over a few minor talking points about mechanics and improvements. Like, I barely talked about enemy code. I didn't talk about how Clickteam Fusion actually makes it kind of difficult to fix bugs in this thing. But videos of this quality and this detail take an extraordinarily long time to make, and games take even longer than that. You gotta cut it off somewhere. So that's all I have to say about Bubsy right now. See you in the next video.